Welcome to Intergalactic Relations, a University of Sussex podcast. On this season's podcast, we explore the liberal utopianism of Star Trek The Next Generation. From the profound optimism of early seasons mirroring the optimism at the end of the Cold War, to the pessimism that creeps into the show a few years later as the inhuman results of shock therapy in the former Soviet Union and US misadventure in Somalia showed the limits of that post-Cold War order. We hope you'll learn a little about Star Trek and a little about international relations. Hi everyone, welcome. I'm Dr. Fahd Shaikh, lecturer in international relations at the University of Sussex. I love Star Trek The Next Generation, though I'm a little disturbed by the incredibly lax research ethics on display in this episode. Who's ever heard of a researcher getting married and starting a family with one of their research subjects? With me are my co-hosts, Dr. Sarah Bulmer, Senior Lecturer in Politics and International Relations at the University of Exeter. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Fies.
And Dr. Dan Watson, Consultant Researcher on Civil Wars and Peacebuilding. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Excellent. For this episode, we watched Homeward, which is Season 7, Episode 13. In this episode, we meet, for the first time, I think, Worf's stepbrother? Worf is a Klingon who serves as head of security on the ship. If you want to know more about the characters, we have a very brief episode zero, which goes over the main cast of the show. And he was adopted. So he's a Klingon who was adopted by a human family. And this is his human brother called Nikolai Roshenko. We meet this brother who is some kind of anthropologist, maybe a scientist who is charged with observing and cataloguing the life of a pre-warp species, which in the terminology of the show means these are a people who don't know how to travel through space and therefore are sort of off limits to everyone, because Star Trek has this rule called the Prime Directive, which says we do not interfere with pre-warp civilizations. So if you don't know how to travel through the stars yet, we're not going to make contact with you and sort of ruin your world and tell you that everything you believe in is wrong, and here we are in spaceships flying through the galaxy. Once you can travel through space, and then no holds barred.
Fair game.
Yeah, you're fair game. And so this is a pre-warp civilization. These are primitive in the language of the show. This scientist is meant to be observing them and sort of learning about them. But there's some cataclysm on this planet, and the whole planet's atmosphere is going to dissipate, and the whole planet's going to become uninhabitable in a matter of hours. It's some unique and strange phenomenon, which they've never really observed before. And, of course, this means that all the people on the planet, this entire species of people that Nikolai is observing, are going to
perish,
yes. And Nikolai, the cheeky chap, decides to break the Prime Directive and compel the crew of the Enterprise to help him help these people. These people are called the Borallans. And he tries to rehome them, basically, take them to a new planet, and in doing so, break this Prime Directive that we do not interfere with the lives of pre-warp civilizations. That's the episode in a nutshell. We are going to first discuss the episode, do a little bit of lay media criticism, talk about what we liked, what we didn't like about the episode. Then we will apply some of our international relations analysis to the issues that we identify in the episode. And finally, we're going to talk about how this connects to our overarching theme of this season, which is liberal utopia. Let's get started and talk about the issues we had with the episode. What are we thinking?
I liked it. I thought it's like your classic ethical dilemma conundrum episode. I think the Prime Directive really lends itself to that type of setup. And I think this is it's a fairly stilted kind of trudge through some of these dilemmas. But it's but there's enough that's enjoyable.
How about you, Sarah? Did you like it?
I do. I mean, I think it raises like interesting issues, and it's sort of its time, isn't it? If it was sort of aired in 1994, it was really when you were starting to think about humanitarian intervention in world politics and whether Western states should intervene to prevent atrocities and genocides and things like that. And so this is sort of like that sort of dynamic. So it kind of makes sense. But it's got so many like weird plot holes and lazy stuff in it to make it work that I find that really annoying. And I also just find Nikolai's sexual predation really creepy, and the episode doesn't really engage with that.
Yes, we didn't talk about that yet. So let's discuss. I presented him as a scientist earlier, and that might make him akin to who we are here as researchers working in universities. And we have certain ethical standards that we're meant to uphold, certain things we have to agree to before we engage in participant research. Nikolai, the character in the show, seems to have no such limitations.
He's a free agent.
Yeah, he went to this community. He was meant to be observing them. He ended up falling in love with one of the ladies there. More than that, he's gotten her pregnant. He's going to have start a family with them. It's really messed up, right? Because these are presented as really superstitious and people who don't, you know, they don't know about the universe, and they believe in seers who can tell the future and people who have control over the weather and this and the other. And here's this spaceman, Nikolai, who, you know, comes in and presumably uses all his knowledge that he has that they don't to impress them, to seduce this lady. I don't know. We don't see any of it. It's left to the imagination, but yeah, it's not cool. And the show does not address it.
It's really gross.
What does Worf say about it?
He said you have dishonored this woman. But then that's all that's said about it. And then in the end, it's all like happy, happy, fine. And like no one says anything about it.
Yeah. He says at the end, I mean, spoiler, they succeed in their mission. They save the Borellans and they relocate them to a new planet without them knowing what happened.
Well, only one village though, isn't it?
Only one village
of Borellans.
Only one village. And then Nikolai says at the end, you know, I'm going to stay here because I'm taking responsibility. I've knocked this woman up and this child needs a father.
Such a narcissist.
But, like, why isn't he... Take responsibility means, like, answer for your crimes, mate. Like, you've broken many rules, surely, laws, and you need to, like, go to prison or something. I don't know. Not that I'm all about incarceration, but it's just weird that that's...
Lock him up, throw away the keys, and fires. It's a solution to every problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, it's a very strange way to talk about taking responsibility, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think one of the issues with this episode is the kind of ye olde society that it portrays, that it's very much like human society, kind of play, like a kind of fantasy King Arthur society. He kind of reeled backwards, and then you end up with this. And it's a bit improbable that that another society would evolve in precisely the same way, or at least in the stylized way.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Nikolai's sexual predations aside, the crux of it, as we've said, is this moral conundrum around interfering or not interfering. What responsibility does this spacefaring civilization with seemingly limitless power have towards a community under threat, in this case, sort of threat from climate, that's going to wipe them out? Do they have a responsibility to intervene? And I think, and that's maybe, I don't know, is that more satisfying than the sort of dramas of Nikolai and his wife? I think so. That the show does that fairly well, right? Like you said, Dan, it's a bread and butter sort of issue in Star Trek. They come back to this again and again to sort of deal with different aspects of this same ethical dilemma. So yeah, are we satisfied with that aspect of the episode?
To an extent, I think that part of the issue is that, keeping in mind that the format of Star Trek The Next Generation is a little different to what came later, where you had storylines that kind of carried on over seasons, you don't really get any kind of resolution to... Like, this is the kind of dilemma that ought to have been considered when coming up with the Prime Directive. Like, is it actually in someone's interest? If you can prevent a disaster without them realising it, should you do it, essentially? Perhaps that this could have had been given a bit more thought. But instead, they kind of bumble their way through this dilemma because of the maverick actions, essentially, of Nikolai. And there's no more reflection, at least none that we see as the audience, about whether this... The Prime Directive does need to be kind of modified to take into account extreme situations such as this one, or in the there's other situations you could imagine, let's say to prevent an infiltration of a pre-warp society by another warp-capable society, should you then get involved, yada yada. So there's a lot there with the Prime Directive that is good, but a lot that is there's a lot of blind spots too, and I would have liked to see a bit more discussion of those. And see how it might have influenced the Federation's thinking.
I think that the episode leaves the Prime Directive sort of intact. As much as we three are noticing issues with it, I think it's still meant to be this wonderful thing, and Nikolai should never have messed it up in the first place. You know, Picard has this little speech when they are observing, they think that the Borallans are going to be wiped out by this atmospheric sort of calamity. And they're watching it happen on their view screen, and Picard gives this like speech, or it's a somber moment when you see this sort of thing happen, but we are bound to do it because the Prime Directive, blah, blah, blah. And little do they know that, you know, Nikolai's sort of pulled a fast one and tricked everyone to accidentally helping them. But that moment, that speech is meant to be, I think, the sort of bow on the Prime Directive that says this is a good thing. So yeah, I'm not sure what's left to explore then in that regard.
He says, this is one of those times when we must face the ramifications of the Prime Directive and honour those lives which we cannot save. But yeah, and it's supposed to be this big moral kind of absolute standpoint. And it just made me think that it's all really biopolitical, isn't it? Starfleet as an organisation has the power to, like, let people die or make them live, or, you know, that's kind of what's going on here.
You've committed the cardinal sin of referencing a term that you'll now have to explain, Sarah. What is biopolitics?
I don't work on biopolitics. I struggle. I struggle with these kind of abs. Yes, can we please? I don't work because it feels quite abstract to me. As I understand it, it's about a form of governmental power in the Foucauldian sense, power of the state or the government to administer life, essentially.
Yeah.
And Foucault talked about it developing in the 19th century, I think, and then onwards, as like we had the development of science and different forms of knowledge. That's what I think. But then there's a Agamben, isn't there? There's all these other ones, these other like varieties.
Oh, as is usual, yeah. I guess any sort of theoretical repertoire, it has its different strands. But yeah, international relations, more or less, there's a large field called post-structuralism, and within that, there's a key figure called Michel Foucault, and Michel Foucault talks about and writes about biopolitics, or wrote about, biopolitics. Certainly none of us here are fluent in biopolitics, but it's out there if you're interested to learn more.
But they do quite a good job of showing how massive this is, this power that they have, because Beverly is the one that is struggling with it, isn't it? She, because later on they're looking for a planet and she suddenly gets overwhelmed by the enormity of what they're doing and the fact that they, you know, what they choose could totally influence what happens with this species.
And that doing nothing is not a choice was one of the things I believe she's
exactly about. choosing to do nothing is still a choice. So I think it does get at this power to manage life and populations. So there's a sort of interesting kind of commentary there on the ethics of that.
Absolutely.
When you have all this technology, how do you know?
Yep.
And, of course, this was all mirroring debates that were going on, or certainly that were going to happen, in the late 90s, before we had responsibility to protect. It was exactly the same thing. If we can intervene, should we intervene? But we have this principle of non-intervention. It's in the UN Charter. But can we, like, breach it in exceptional circumstances? I mean, all this stuff was starting to sort of take, you know, root at the end of the Cold War. So, again, it's kind of ahead of its time. They're kind of having an R2B-style debate. And that wasn't until 2000 that you had that sort of developed as an idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess we're going to go back to responsibility to protect, R2P, and other ways in which the show, this episode, might be talking to our politics in the next section. So we have one more thing to discuss before we move on to that, which is one of the Borallan characters, a guy called Vorin. He escapes the simulation that Nikolai, the brother, has created on the ship. The ship has this elaborate sort of recreational facility which allows them to simulate any environment that they like. It's called the holodeck. And what he does, without the crew knowing, is that he transports the under-threat Borallans onto this simulation of their home world so that they don't know what's happening, while the ship flies through space to find a new planet that they can deposit the people on. But someone forgot to lock the door, and this guy just walks out of the simulation onto the corridors of the spaceship and is suddenly surrounded by space people. He has no idea what's going on. He looks out the window, it's stars. Completely freaks him out. What happens with this guy, and what is there anything important that the show is talking about here with his character? What do we think?
I think the role of Vorin is to keep a focus on the downsides, if you like, of intervention. That's kind of his role in, like, the plot. But what I think is interesting about him is the way that he's always talking about, well, how can we... How will we make sense as a culture and as a, like, people if we're not in the place where we, you know, we were? So it's like he's there with this sort of really essentialized kind of understanding of what the Borallans are. And it's all about we need a past and we need, you know, all these things that make us who we are. So this is quite interesting kind of questions about, yeah, what makes a society or a culture? And is it about the past and a sense of place? And so what does your future look like if you've had that taken away and ripped away from you? So, yeah, he's kind of interesting. And in the end, he can't take it, can he? Because he knows his choice is either to stay in the Federation and just get his head around the 24th century space travel, and he's from this pre-warp civilization. You know, he used to do the chronicles, so they were still recording the history of their village through pictures. So that's the level of the culture that he's come from. So he has that choice, or he has the choice to go back, and then he can either choose to try and tell them, but they won't understand and they might just think he's crazy, or he has to go back and pretend he doesn't know. And in the end, he commits ritual suicide, doesn't he? Because he just can't... He can't make it work.
Is given his position, the thing he says to... I can't remember who, the doctor or the captain or somebody, is without our past, we have no future.
Yeah, the future means nothing. Yes.
If he goes back to his society, he knows that, he alone knows that they have no past. Like, they've been, their links to their home, their cultural and spiritual life has been ended because they've been transplanted to a new planet. So according to his own sort of worldview, he has, and they have, no life. And the other option of staying on the ship equally damns him in his worldview, because he, in choosing to stay with them on the ship, he's also denied his cultural and spiritual connections to place which matter to their people. So, yeah, in the end, this ritual suicide does seem like a consistent end for someone with such a worldview.
It's interesting because he really, his pursuit of this authenticity, of this kind of authentic existence, is such a contrast to Nikolai, who's just like, let's roll the dice, see what happens. We'll just plant them somewhere else and just,
Well, yeah, and he's living a lie. I mean, he's literally, like, fooling this woman.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got no qualms with that. Yeah, so they're set up as kind of these opposite attitudes to life and society and what makes a life worth living, what makes a future, how important the past is. And it's kind of interesting because Star Trek does that a lot, doesn't it? It likes to almost fetishize the past. And we've talked about a bit bit about this in terms of like the racialization of these past cultures. There's a lot to bring the Native Americans in. I think we're talking about that in a future episode. But they really love that. They love this like scientific futurism, and then they love contrasting that with the past and cult. That's where the culture is. It's in the past. And so, yeah. So they're playing with that in this episode as well. But it's a common thing, I think, that they have.
It's interesting, though, in a way, like the cultural sterility of the present-day Federation, it almost compels them to explore and dig around to find deeper and richer cultural experiences. Maybe that's part of their mission.
Mm. And then there's the bit, you know, when Vorin dies and Picard then says how he'd like to have got to know him. And I'm like, what? You were happy to watch this guy die? Like, what are you talking about? But apart from that, he says... And Beverly says, oh, well, he would have died anyway if we hadn't acted. So therefore, he's committed suicide. He would have died anyway. So, you know, zero sum, like, it's he's dead either way. But then Picard says he wouldn't have died scared and alone. And I think that's also interesting because it's about deepening our conversation away from just life and death and numbers and how many people can you save. And again, these were debates that were going on and are still going on in world politics now to sort of inform ethical decisions. On what basis do we make these kinds of decisions?
Can we talk a little bit about Nikolai's gleeful sort of disregard of the rules and the stuffiness of Starfleet's sort of chain of command and all the rest of it that we've mentioned a few times before? This is before we know that he is a sex pest. So, but in our notes, we were very sympathetic towards the character before we knew this about him. But there is this moment in sort of the first half of the show where everyone's trying to be really angry with him. Like, how dare you, Nikolai? This is such a big deal. Your career is over. And he's just got a smile on his face. And he's like, yep, I know. I don't care. I'd do it again. They've got nothing on him. They can't make him feel bad. And so they can't do anything to him. It's really nice to see. I really like it.
So my favourite, well, because I was watching it with my fiance Rosie, and she was saying, it was right at the end when the holodeck is about to sort of malfunction, but they're nearly at the planet. Georgie conjures up a sort of fake storm. Like, Worf's like, be great if you could maybe come up with a storm now. And Geordi's like, gotcha. One of the last scenes with Nikolai is him pushing people into tents, and then he trips over a bowl as he's running to meet to meet Worf, and it feels so slapdash and like Benny Hill comedy. I really enjoyed it.
That's who he is, right? Worf calls him at one point, and he's an agent of chaos wherever he goes. Like, other people have to clean up his problems and stuff like this, and
I mean, and that to me was one of the main themes of this chaos versus order kind of theme, with, you know, Worf personifying the rigidity of order, and Picard to an extent as well, although he's turns out to be a bit more flexible when push comes to shove. But Nikolai being this kind of chaotic force that leads us to potentially some positive outcomes, but also some questionable ones too.
Mm. And that was also a debate going on at the time between justice and order in the world system.
We can't stop. We have to talk about IR. So, okay, let's move on then and talk about how the episode might speak to our contemporary sort of world politics or our IR theories, or what our IR theories can maybe help us unpack of the show. As usual, this is an episode that we watched at the University of Sussex during a seminar series last academic year. And at that time, I had three colleagues watch with me, a postgraduate researcher, Paul Ryman, Dr. Alistair Markland, who's now at the University of Oxford Brookes, and Dr. David Karp. And they had some really interesting things to say. Paul, coming from a project on human rights, was talking about, or wanted to reflect on, what it means to protect somebody. And that the episode does well in explaining the difference between protecting somebody physically, like you've literally saved a life, but you have stripped them from their spiritual and cultural life. So have you protected them really? Like, if you lose the latter, what's the point of the former? So what is it you want to protect when you're intervening? Alistair moved on the conversation to talk about the aid givers themselves, which reflects his research. And he talked about how the Prime Directive in Star Trek resembles similar ethical diktats in the aid sector in our world, and that these ethical dilemmas create existential crises for aid workers, much as it did and does for Nikolai and Worf. So in that sense, art was very much imitating life there. And then David wanted, he reflected on how the episode is framed as powerful men deciding things on behalf of others. And in this regard, had something to say around developmental ethics, what are our duties to distant strangers, and wanted to talk about global ethics, as again, reflecting more his specialism. What he thought was interesting about the episode is that it wasn't presented as doing harm versus doing no harm, but about every choice you make is a different level of harm, and you have to make decisions about what level of harm you're willing to live with. And I think that, yeah, was well reflected in the episode. So those were things that were brought up when we discussed it previously, and maybe we want to pick up on some of those aspects as we discuss it. From what colleagues have said, or anything that comes to your mind, what do we want to say about how the episode relates to world politics, beyond what we've already talked about with regards to responsibility to protect?
Just on that theme of responsibility to protect, I mean, one of the things that Nikolai is essentially doing is taking the Borallans and essentially the Enterprise said we're not going to have anything to do with them because of the Prime Directive, and it's making them their responsibility by physically transporting them into the holodeck, which I thought was quite interesting, a sort of more kind of activist player there.
Yeah, for sure. This thing about deciding between levels of harm, that's something that Dr. Crusher says. In fact, there's this the first sort of stern meeting that they have with Nikolai on the Enterprise with all the main cast of characters. He's making his case that, you know, I can't just let them die, we need to do something, and everyone's like, shame on you, the Prime Directive, etc. And the only one who nods in agreement with him and shows any sympathy towards his position is Dr. Crusher, who we've known in previous episodes has this humanitarian streak to her. And one of the things she says is that doing nothing is also a choice. It's also doing harm. It's letting them die. And I really like that. I don't know that that's something that, while it's discussed in academic debate, I don't know if that's something that percolates sort of societal discourse around responsibility to protect, or the reasons why you might intervene in, as the UK has done in various countries, Libya, notably now in Yemen, in Israel-Palestine, etc.
Yeah, so one of the, just on this point about responsibility to protect, or R2P, this kind of doctrine emerged in the late 90s, and the South Sudanese academic and practitioner, Francis Deng, was one of the pioneers of the concept. And this the notion behind it was that a government has a condition of sovereignty, was that rather than sovereignty simply being a shield through which a government can protect itself with, it has certain duties and responsibilities to its population, and if it is failing to meet those, then intervention can then become an option that's on the table.
But I think the significance of this, and why it's been such a big debate in IR and continues to be when we're talking about the world order, is because we often talk about the end of the Second World War and the birth of the UN Charter as the sort of state system, when it had the rules of the game in it. And the rules of the game were no intervention, right? State sovereignty is like prime, right? So you don't intervene in other states unless it's in the case of self-defense, so Chapter 7, or unless the Security Council actually gets together and authorizes it. And even then, they're only allowed to authorize it to protect the security of international peace and security, right? So there's a lot of latitude there, but like the general principle is like non-intervention. And then after the end of the Cold War and the move away from this bipolar world with the Soviet Union, which made a lot of these issues really tricky because you had areas of influence and proxy wars and all sorts of stuff like this. So the whole idea was that in, you know, with the triumph of liberalism, with the triumph of the Western way of life, then we could start to think about promoting human rights. And then, as Dan's saying, there was this conditional idea of sovereignty. So sovereignty is not your just inherent right as your estate. It's kind of conditional on you looking after your populace to a minimum level. And then they, you know, and then the West started doing lots of interventions, which were illegal, but seemed to be legitimate. So they were trying to come up with a way of discourse and a protocol and principles to try and kind of catch up with practice that was already happening. And the whole idea of that was that then you put a framework around it and it's less open to abuse and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But what I think is interesting about this episode is that often a lot of these frameworks and principles and things like the Prime Directive, things like sovereignty, they're used as almost a little like ethical safety blanket, like comfort blanket. You're like, well, I've got this principle and so that I don't need to make the decision because the decision's already made. And then this episode is really good at showing that all the decisions are political. And that's, you know, so much work has been done in IR showing that all of these things are politically kind of contextualized and need to be understood in complex ways. And then thinking about aid work and the whole idea of do no harm and aid being a political, humanitarianism being neutral. So much work has shown that that's not possible. So even aid can end up being used to food aid, for example, can get taken by militia groups and then used to fuel the fighting. So there is no neutral, safe, ethical place from which to make these political decisions. And I think the episode really shows that. And I think that's actually quite sort of subversive for the time, because we had this whole end of history, liberalism's triumphed, human rights, kind of, you know, we know the way, we know we have the answers. And actually this episode's like, well, it's actually all a bit contentious.
Yeah, so just to also build on that, one of the issues with R2P as a doctrine is that it doesn't necessarily ask why states are failing to fulfil their duties. Now, in a particular staging ground for a lot of interventions in the 90s and early 2000s in particular was in Africa. Now, the reason that a lot of countries, a lot of states within Africa became increasingly unstable was in part because of actual Western liberal ideals, particularly structural adjustment in the 1980s that followed from economic turbulence in the late 70s. And these structural adjustment programs resulted in states being kind of hollowed out, evacuated, and increasingly unstable and often unviable entities. Additionally, after the Cold War, a number of former Soviet countries wanted to realign away from Russia and towards the Western camp. And to do that, one of the conditions of that was that they could not have weapons or ammunition that were compatible with other Warsaw Pact countries. They instead had to move towards NATO standards for their munitions and weapons. So what they did was they dumped a load of these arms onto the black market, particularly in Africa, and thus added fuel to the fire that was already raging. So there's a big circularity with some of this responsibility to protect stuff, because it encapsulates a kind of liberal, benevolent paternalism, but it fails to understand why it got, how liberalism helped produce this situation in the first place, and also that politics is not something that is pristine and siloed off from economic forces or geopolitical events happening far away.
One of the more insidious sort of effects of the language of intervention for me is precisely that dynamic, Dan, that to say, like, we have a choice now to intervene in Libya or not, makes it seem like we haven't been involved up until now, when we are deeply connected with the crises that led up to, say, the fall of Gaddafi. And then, but the framing of should we intervene or not makes it sound like thus far we've been not, you know, this isn't about us, but we're choosing to get involved with strangers. Like, no, we're intimately connected to this through our support for opposition, support for Gaddafi at various points in time, the ways in which, you know, that regime was able to accumulate resources, etc., was very much linked to similar dynamics that you've been discussing, Dan. one of the things the episode talks about, I think, yeah, is subversive. I agree with you, Sarah, that that maybe a world that heeded this episode's warning wouldn't have intervened in Iraq in 2003. And maybe that would have been, I don't know, better. I mean, it's really hard to play with counterfactuals. I'm not going to, you know, die on that hill. But the idea that interventions in the Middle East was were to make us safer and then we ended up creating ISIS, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't feel safer. And the episode tries to warn us about this when Data and Beverly are trying to find a new home for the Borallans and are talking about, well, what, you know, I think you mentioned it already, Sarah, like discussing the enormity of the situation and how much they don't know about what they're trying to do. What are the unseen consequences of this and that, of the other? But certainly at the time, and I remember 2003 quite well, you know, it was all very, it's going to be great. There's no questions that we can't answer. This is going to be good for the region. We're going to create a democracy in the Middle East and we're going to get rid of a crazy person in Saddam, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know.
It's peak liberal arrogance, isn't it? It was peak liberal arrogance.
Arrogance, that's it. That's it. On peak liberal arrogance, maybe that's also mirrored in the fact that they didn't lock the doors of the flipping holodeck so this guy could just walk out because they were just like, well, they're, you know, backwards sort of spiritual cave dwelling, whatever. So, you know, we don't have to we don't have to lock the doors because he doesn't know how to use a door or something like this. Very weird. Yeah. And then he stumbles out and creates this problem.
Yeah, paternalism at its best.
Can you just hold off one sec? I just want to pick up a book and read something from it because I think it'll be relevant.
Okay.
I'd just like to read a quote from this book, Carbon Democracy by Timothy Mitchell. And he's talking about the Iraq invasion. An American expert on democracy sent to southern Iraq 9 months after the US invasion of 2003 to discuss capacity building with members of the provincial council said, "Welcome to your new democracy," he said as he began displaying PowerPoint slides of the administrative structure that the Americans had designed. "I have met you before. I have met you in Cambodia. I have met you in Russia. I have met you in Nigeria." At which point, we are told, two members of the council walked out. Thought it was a great kind of this kind of idea that you can just transpose something from like a PowerPoint and redesign a society. And I think there's a kind of connection here because one of the things that Worf does at the end is take this kind of picture historical record from this society, which is their archive, their kind of history, and he just removes it and takes it with him. Now, that's essentially, it's very similar, this idea of like a kind of blank slate that a society goes from one stage to another and essentially reborn. It's untainted or unconnected or untethered to its past. But you don't know what the ramifications of that will be. And in reality, no society ever is unburdened by its past.
So that leads us on neatly to the final aspect of the episode where we're going to talk about what we've learned about the utopianism of the show or liberal utopia in general, which we're arguing is what Star Trek The Next Generation presents to us, some kind of liberal humanist utopia. This is another one for me that I'm confused on. The episode narrative makes it look like Nikolai's successfully sort of saved these people. The intervention was a good thing. Even Worf comes around to that fact near the end of the episode. But on principle, he has transgressed. This is against the rules. This isn't good. And they have talked about the enormity of the problem and how, you know, we're doing this thing and we hope it's going to help, but we don't know what the long-term ramifications are and if this is even going to work. So I don't know what that means, and I don't know whether Nikolai's successful intervention is a reflection of the liberal utopia of the show or a sort of an aberration. Sort of in this liberal utopia, they would have let them all die, unknowing of the wider world and space travel, etc. and that's the quote-unquote right thing to do. I don't know. Any thoughts?
I'm reminded in this episode of that teach a man to fish kind of sort of proverb, like, and this is really crude kind of idea of, but it's shared by a lot of capacity building notions that you build up a country's quote-unquote capacity, whatever that means, and then they're able to essentially be freestanding and do things themselves and don't require handouts or charity or that kind of stuff. Now, what's happened here is that a society has been taken from one planet to another. They're clearly going to be ecologically different. They're going to have different animals, different plant lives, different soil types. But the only similarity is they are both Class M planets, which seems to be what Star Trek says whenever they want a habitable planet. It's Class M. You've got one small village and that's it. There's what the long-term future of the species will be when your gene pool is that limited, where the diversity is coming from Nikolai himself, presumably. What is going to happen to this society as it develops? I mean, he could sleep with a lot of people, and suspect he will. Then you're going to get loads of little Nikolais. It's going to be an inbreeding nightmare. How are they going to... They'll encounter pathogens they're not familiar with. Their farming techniques may not work in this new... There might be different seasons because it will be a different distance from the sun. It might spin at a different rate, the planet. Like, you're going to have to... If you want to be responsible... Keep an eye on these people and help them out, and probably have to break the illusion at some point, guys. Like, sorry, here's what's happened here. I think for me, it's this kind of incompetent utopia that's on display.
Going back to R2P, this is one of the things that they try to address, and they with the responsibility to rebuild the three pillars. So it's not just about intervening; it's preventing, reacting, so intervening, and then rebuilding. And so within that liberal project, there's the idea that you have to help rebuild after all of this has happened. But as we can see now, the West's success at, effectiveness at doing that is very limited, very limited. If you even, and there are other critical voices that say that that's not even what people were actually trying to do, because this is just the colonial legacy of exploitation. But I think the episode... As a narrative, it ends up with a sort of like, oh, it's okay then. So in that sense, it is. But then I think, Fies, your point about, like, would liberalism just let these people die? That's also interesting, because there's all that work about how the liberal utopia works for the people in the centre, but it's only reliant on massive violence to the people on the periphery. So I think...
Yeah,
you could read it both ways. Like, what is the liberal utopia, actually? Yeah.
And if I'm so critical of the, let's say, the 2003 Iraq invasion, is what I'm saying that in the language of the show, we should have let those people die just as we shouldn't have intervened in Iraq. I don't know. That's a tough one.
I think one of the ethical dilemmas that many of us probably experience when we think on world affairs is that we're engaging with a world that was never of our own making. Like, Saddam Hussein is the outgrowth of various forms of imperial activity in the Middle East, and you're then left to deal with the conundrum. Like, look at the kind of the argument, well, if you don't do anything, then you've got this tyrant who undoubtedly abused people, and if I were Iraqi, I'd probably want him to have been removed. But as what do you do in that situation? Do you say it feels like a kind of almost like a setup that you have to say, well, no, I support this ongoing bad situation because I think it won't be as bad as the unknown.
I think there's something to that, because what it says is, maybe I can be... There are more choices than action or inaction. And this idea that I can either support the removal of Saddam Hussein or non-intervention paints people who don't want to intervene as people who are uncaring for the plight of Iraqis.
Yeah, it's a kind of ethical blackmail.
Blackmail, right? And I think we're familiar with that, because that's exactly what happened in British society when Tony Blair took us to war. But... there's more to it than that. There's maybe being accountable to all the support that we gave Saddam Hussein during the 80s, and how can we rectify that? If indeed he is a bad guy, why did we help him, and how do we how do we change the narrative on that, change the material realities of that? Because we support, we taxpaying British people support dictators across the world. Saddam is one example of that, but currently in Egypt, for example, we support General Sisi, Sisi's regime, with military aid, etc. So these are the things that I think we can do something about, and it's not that our only option is to, you know, cut off the head and do a Iraq invasion. We've got to be accountable to the various other things that we're doing, as is coming to the fore now in the significant discourse around UK support to Israel. We're becoming aware of all the ways in which we are supporting a regime that maybe British citizens don't want to support, with regards to military aid, the sale of weapons, the literal flying of our British warplanes to provide intelligence, etc. We're becoming aware of all the ways in which we're complicit, and no one's calling for regime change in Israel as if that was on the menu, right? But we are saying we can maybe stop doing some of these things, whereas in the Iraq discourse, it was zero sum. It was either we remove him or we're complicit, which is, yeah, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with that. But just to say that maybe the picture is more complicated than what the show is making out with its you can do something or do nothing versus contemporary examples of intervention that we've been quite critical of, all of us.
Well, maybe the liberal utopia has to rely on a simplified narrative that kind of erases lots of stuff. Because otherwise you just can't tell the story of liberalism. You can't tell the story of promoting human rights. You can't tell that, because there's always a load of other examples where things like, as Dan said about the IMF interventions, actually created conditions that undermine human rights. And then, you know, so all these things have to be looked at as the complex political situations that they are. But liberal utopia relies on these kind of discursive shorthands that kind of sweep all that away and give us a nice, neat little kind of easily digestible idea. So intervene or not, you know, promote human rights or not.
Nice. So then we're back to a somewhat familiar sort of theme for the podcast, which is that liberal utopia is somewhat artificial. It's not so substantive and has to do a lot of sort of kicking underneath the water to stay afloat. And what we're seeing in the show and in this episode is sort of exactly the amount of work that needs to happen. It's not this wonderful principled world that sort of descends from on high and we all live up to some principles, but rather, yeah, it's politics. It's playing out right now, and we can see it in the episode and indeed in our world, our non-Star Trek world.
I think it's absolutely... This is quite incredible that they made this, I guess, in 1993, because it touches on so many issues that were going to become really big throughout the whole of the 1990s and up into the early 2000s. And yet, this was before Rwanda. This is sort of post-Gulf War no-fly zones, which was like the first kind of like sort of intervention that was done by Western powers. And then, yes, the Somalia disaster. But there was so much more to come. Rwanda, Bosnia, Kosovo. Yeah. And then, of course, Afghanistan, Iraq, and on and on and on. And yet, they made this, and it's touching on all those issues. Ahead of its time, I think.
We're going to be able to pick up more of those themes in the next episode, where we discuss preemptive strike, which deals with, I think, a lot of the support for militantism. That is the other part of this discussion, I guess, intervening to save lives, but also intervening to make sure the right people win in a civil war or some sort of domestic conflict. And that's what the next episode is going to be about. So in a way, maybe these two go together real nice.
Can I make a point? It might be one that's better slotted in elsewhere, but one of the themes... sorry, scratch that. One of the the issues that come. One of the contradictions that, that this episode brings to the fore is that Star Trek shows a society that is proactive in how it wants to engage with different problems, that sees itself as ambassadors for the good and so on. But the Prime Directive must really be, must create an awful lot of headaches, if not heartaches, for the kind of the model sort of Starfleet citizen who is going out there to fix all these different problems and uphold good things. And then you're basically told, oh, but you can't do that here in these circumstances. I think it's quite an interesting juxtaposition between the kind of the moral imperatives of the kind of pioneer attitude of Starfleet.
Yeah. But I wonder if they still make themselves, the narrative is one that will still make themselves feel good about it, I suspect, because what they'll say is, we can't help in this situation with pre-warp civilizations, the Prime Directive, precisely because we're better than the dastardly Cardassians who would have just sort of come in and enslaved all these people because they're not, their lives are worthless because precisely because they're not pre-warp, precisely because they are pre-warp. We're going to let them develop, and then when they're ready, we're going to come and we're going to shake their hands as friends instead of sort of as conquerors, which is what the other spacefaring races of Star Trek presumably do. That is it for this week. We'll see you next week we'll see you in 2 weeks' time for Preemptive Strike. That's Season 7, Episode 24. We're going to go slightly out of order for these final two episodes of the season. We're going to talk about Preemptive Strike as a nice companion episode to the one we discussed today, and then we're going to have a lot of fun with the final episode, Journey's End, Season 7, Episode 20, because it is just on another level of awful compared to everything we've discussed thus far. Okay, with that, I'll say bye to Dan.
Goodbye.
And bye, Sarah.
Bye, Fives.
All right, see you all in 2 weeks' time. Thank you for listening to Intergalactic Relations. This podcast is made possible by the International Relations Department at the University of Sussex. Please subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes.